Welcome to the summer series of the Bowden Education Podcast, hosted by me, Catherine Carden. In this series, I'll be chatting to education experts around a range of topics that will hopefully get you thinking and inspire you in your work. They certainly inspire me. Today, I'm delighted to be speaking to Roger Broadbent, who is the director of the Dyslexia Institute UK. Roger's work has specialised in dyslexia for many years with a range of organisations and learners of varying ages. Through his work, Roger is keen to highlight the issues around dyslexia, the ramifications of undiagnosed and unsupported dyslexia for communities. Roger believes when addressing dyslexia, a team approach must be adopted through bringing together different sectors. And I hope we can discuss this in our conversation today. Welcome, Roger.
Morning, Catherine.
So our paths have briefly crossed, I think, previously, just as we've been in the same Zoom online meeting, I think, at one point. So I think that's where I clocked you. So it's really nice to have a longer discussion about your work today. But before we start, can you take just a short while to summarise your career to date?
Yeah, I'm a dyslexic individual who was diagnosed later in my life. And as a consequence of that, I've become really passionate about dyslexia and all things dyslexia. But I've done my PGCE at Edgehill University. I was 10 years a support study coach at the universities, University of Manchester, MMU, University of Salford, Keele, etc. And I've kind of dedicated myself for the last 10, 15 plus years to trying to make a difference in dyslexia in our community, but also in neurodiversity in general.
And so talk to me then about what drives and inspires you to continue to work in education. It's really tough. It's a tough gig, education. I say this regularly because we can invest and try and, you know, lots of teachers say they want to make a difference, lots of individuals do, but seemingly come up quite often against these big sort of barriers. So what inspires you to continue to work in education?
I think frustration in a nutshell. I get angry and annoyed and frustrated that there are so many issues around neurodiversity and dyslexia that are not being addressed effectively, and that we are failing so many people across the UK. It's not just a UK issue, it's a global issue. We're not doing this in a smart way in America, in Europe. We're just not doing it. And that's what I want us to start to do better. And small changes, I think the light is starting to come through the chink in the curtain. I think we're starting to reveal a bit more. I think we're starting to challenge a lot of the fear around issues like dyslexia, dyscalculia, and all this. I also, in education, I want to challenge some of the kind of core issues that allow educators to give us these myths that kids are thick because they make spelling mistakes, or that pupils that can't remember loads of information for exams are less intelligent than their peers. I think it's wrong that we're allowed to stigmatize people for the way that they're born. You know, dyslexic, autistic kids, ADHD kids, they don't choose to be born that way. And I want to make sure that when I'm 6 foot under, that things have been moved just a fraction. The angle of perception has been shifted just a little bit so that we can start to think properly in a more inclusive way in the way that we educate.
And the challenge is, though, and slightly sort of away from what was going to be my next question, but it might link into it, is the system that's around education. So the framework of how we judge and measure in education is very much, and has become, more so actually than when I was at school, the framework of judgment is about remembering, and it says it, Ofsted say it, Gove kept saying it when he was Secretary of State, knowing more, remembering more, as if that is what learning is about. So that's really hard. The measurement is challenging the idea, isn't it? from an educator's point of view, I mean.
Yeah, and it's quite revolutionary that we should question that, because historically that was always the qualities that were respected by education, universities and what have you. But these days we've got IT. You know, at the press of a button, we can answer virtually any question. We can find any piece of information just like that. So the importance of being able to retain huge swathes of information is diminishing. It's not that important now. What is important is that we use information effectively to find solutions to modern problems so that we can evolve in a more positive way as a community. And that's what I want to see in the UK and beyond. We've still got this really negative perspective of the way that we look at people who are a little different. And it's only that little bit of difference which causes so many problems for so many people. If we think of the number of people who are part of the dyslexia family, and I'm going to put that at 20%, and by that, in the family, I include dyscalculia, dysgraphia, dyspraxia, obviously dyslexia. I would also include scotopic sensitivity, because, you know, the sights, visual stress, I would include that in the family. And that's 20%. That's one in five people. So it's, in my view, I think it's hugely underestimated the number of people that are struggling with this condition, because it's undiagnosed, unrecognized in the educational environment and unsupported. And it's the result of that is that we see that in our communities with lots of individuals who have never been supported to learn about themselves, to better cope with their difference, and to support their families and communities to better understand that, oh, that's why my friend constantly forgets my name. That's why another friend might be late for our meetings, because they've just got a different wiring system, slightly different to other people. And that should be embraced. We shouldn't be trying to encourage people to fail. We should be embracing it and encourage people to succeed with those different mind competencies and abilities.
But it goes back again, and we can link this to curriculum. And I say this to in my time as a teacher educator, I've said it many times to students, and they always look at me when I say this like I'm slightly mad. But I ask the question of, when has a child been taken out of your English class to have a PE intervention or an art intervention or a music intervention? And they look at me, puzzled by my question. Because in their minds, of course, that's nonsense. But I then go on to explain why. And imagine the child's experience. They really struggle in English, or they're really struggling in maths. So they're taken out to do more English, more maths, like as if more is going to solve the challenge. But maybe the only part of joy for them of school and where they can develop to be who they want to be is in PE, is in music. They could be our next great artist, you know, but they're constantly taken out. So the hierarchy of subjects is also not helpful.
Definitely, really good point. I love the way that you phrased that, to challenge teachers' perspectives, or to challenge everybody's perspectives. This constant erosion of young person's self-esteem is damaging, and it lasts a long time. There's not a quick fix to the negative impact of education on young people who don't quite exactly fit the mold of what what the government expects of their pupils. The consequences of that moving forward, we can just see it on our streets. Homeless people in jobs that are below their competency, low self-esteem, low self-confidence. For big chunks of people, you know, people on the autistic spectrum, the unemployment rate of people on the autistic spectrum is just ridiculously high. When these are people just like me and you, just like the rest of us, part of our community, the brothers and sisters of families. We need to be far more accommodating of difference and welcome it and really celebrate it. And like the point that you made there, I thought was lovely. Wouldn't it be nice if a young child, age 6, 7, who is struggling with spelling, was taken out to go and have a kickabout? You know, let's go and do some PE now. Because you can recognise that that individual's really struggling, getting frustrated, being humiliated in front of his or her peers, and just to go and get a bit of fresh air and then have another go, start, you know, try again, but with a different perspective. Yeah. So I love that idea, Catherine. And I do worry about the damage that we do systematically to people in education. Mm-hmm. I do think it is one of the crimes that we need to address.
Well, you know, and you talk about damage to children, and by these interventions, and we know why, and I'm not blaming schools for why they do them. We know because of the pressures they're under, measurements and so on. But every time you remove that child from the class, or they have to come out of another lesson in secondary, for example, to go for more English or whatever, what you're doing is highlighting, and you're kind of saying to them, you're not good. You're not good at this. And we're going to make you fail. And they feel more and more of a failure, and they disengage, as would anybody. You know, if you're going every day to do a job that you hated, and there were little bits you liked, but quite often you were dragged away from the little bits of the job you liked to do more of the rubbish that you hated, you wouldn't want to go to school.
Well, that's why we see such high numbers of truants in the dyslexic population. I think it's something like 80% of truants are dyslexic. I'm just doing some work with, I don't like calling them PRUs, but pupil referral unit. They've got 125 pupils, 70% of which are dyslexic, and between 10 and 20% are ADHD and 10 and 20% on the autistic spectrum. Now, that's obviously a reflection of the local catchment area not being able to cope positively with the neuroatypical individuals in their classroom. And then that pathway, unfortunately, is really tough for those individuals. 80, 90% of those individuals who go to the referral units don't come back into mainstream. The vast majority do not achieve well academically. And then unfortunately, we see too many of these young people who, because of the extra challenges that they've got with their own neurodiversity that no one's ever helped them address, come to terms with, then we see them get in trouble with the law, and then it just becomes a real upward battle for those individuals for the rest of their lives, and for us in our communities.
And of course, a large proportion of these not only have an identified special need that are in referral units and alternative provision, a large proportion are male.
Yeah, that is true, for lots of different reasons. Yeah, that is very true. I just want to come back and a little bit to the point that you made regarding the pressure teachers are under. Teachers do a fantastic job. I'm a qualified teacher myself, and I'm minded of the challenges of the role and the difficulties of the role. I don't want to come across as being a teacher basher. I think teachers are great. I think teachers are under huge pressure, and I think they're under huge pressure with Ofsted and what have you to focus on their kids who are going to be successful for them. Because their roles are almost valued by the success of the pupils that they've got in their classroom. So if they've got a challenging child with behavioural problems, perhaps, who's not the most motivated, who doesn't love the classroom environment perhaps as much as some of the others, I can kind of get why a teacher might want to kind of disassociate some attention from that person and focus on the kids that are going to give them more kudos in their careers moving forward. It's kind of a natural thing that we've manifested. I'm not saying it's good, but I understand where it's coming from. But I'm not trying to demonize teachers as being the kind of the main drivers to this. They're just a reflection of the system that we put in place.
Yeah. So going back to those children with dyslexia in our school system, at whatever stage they're at, what would you say are the key challenges that they face, but also their families face?
Okay, I think number one has got to be just the recognition of the condition. So the British Dyslexic Association, BDA, they did a really good piece of work in 2019, where they discovered that 80% of dyslexic kids were leaving primary school, going on to secondary school, without a diagnosis of their dyslexia. That's 80%. So only 20% were being picked up. I would suggest, although I haven't got evidence for this, but I would suggest anecdotally that the majority of those kids that have been picked up in primary school would have been from, shall we say, better off backgrounds. So we've got this huge tranche of kids who then go on to secondary school without the diagnosis, and I'm going to say that without the diagnosis of dyslexia, ADHD, autistic spectrum, because it's pretty much the same across the piece. Dropping into secondary school, they're already starting to realise that school is going to be a challenging place for them. They don't know why, because nobody's had that conversation with them. Then they start to struggle in the big school, where things start to get serious and they've got exams and regular testing, and they're not performing as well as their peers, and they're not performing as well as their intelligence level should be allowing them to perform in an education system. And that's when we get issues, behavioural issues, withdrawal, alienation, truanting. Again, this absolutely smashing of the self-esteem, this destruction of an individual's self-esteem. Where do we expect an individual's personal development to go with that kind of constant bombardment from what they see as authority? And how do we expect that relationship of between those individuals and what perceived authority moving forward? It's not great. So how can we try and improve that situation for the dyslexic individual and their families? Well, we need to have proper diagnosis. We need then to encourage the individual to control their difference, to learn about their difference, to understand their difference. Somebody said to me the other week, which I thought was really good, it wasn't my idea, so I'm not going to claim it, but they said that being dyslexic or neuroatypical is a bit like having a wild horse. Mm. A wild horse can create all sorts of mayhem. It can kick you in the head. It can cause you lots of problems running about, and you're not able to have a controlled pathway with that horse. If you bring that horse under, you school that horse, and you allow that horse to develop, it can then be wonderful. It can take you on journeys all over the world. It can do great things. And I think being neuroatypical is a bit like that. So what we need to try and evolve is a way to encourage the individual to recognize their difference, to start to learn what that difference means for them, how it impacts them, and what they can do to try and counter some of the negatives and develop those, and to build on some of the positives and develop those as unique individuals that's really welcome in our communities. So I see that as being hugely beneficial. I've got a few other points as well, Catherine, if you don't. I've had my coffee this morning, you know what I mean?
No, you go for it. Carry on.
I think that we need to reflect the population and employ in the teacher population and employ teachers who are neuroatypical, and actively go out and recruit people who are from the dyslexic community, the dyscalculic community, the Asperger's community, ADHD community, and bring them in so that children growing up can see that, oh, sir or miss, or, you know, their teacher makes spelling mistakes, and it's perfectly all right. It's perfectly all right if your sentence isn't absolutely 100% grammatically correct from the get-go. As long as you're expressing your ideas is what we want to encourage in education. And let's get it right. We've got lots of tech that can support with that moving forward. I'd also like to suggest that schools are used more as a community hub, mm-hmm. rather than just a gated community that's only for a bespoke age group. I think there's loads of... there's huge potential for schools to be doing a lot more in their communities to support development of other people of other age ranges to come in at night at tea time, first thing in the morning, and, you know, have extra support classes and learn about neurodiversity. I think it would be really helpful if family members, extended family members of people who would recognize as being neuroatypical would be allowed to come into the school environment and have a screening or an assessment for their own neurodiversity, because these conditions are hereditary. They haven't come out of the ether. This isn't just something because you eat too much milk or something. This is, it's in our DNA. There are other causes, but the vast majority, 80, 90% of the reasons behind neuroatypical brain development is because it is hereditary, simple. But the families of those children who are neuroatypical, it's something like 50% of the parents of neuroatypical kids will be neuroatypical themselves. So I think as part of that learn around the people's individual differences, I think we need to encourage the adult community, the adult people who are engaging with those young people, to recognize their own uniqueness and to go on that journey themselves. I think that would be really positive, and schools could be really good at doing that.
Yeah, I agree. And I think schools should be used as a community hub in a whole variety of ways. I was talking to Stephen Berryman, who's the incoming president of the Charter College, just last week on a podcast. And he has a role of director of arts and culture in a multi-academy trust. And he's extended that to community, because how can you have arts and culture without community? And an FE group that I'm working with has community at the heart of what they do and how they're serving their community. And I think we need to, I completely agree, we need to go back to being schools as a centre and a hub of the community, bringing in people working together and breaking down barriers, because for so many parents, school is a petrifying place. It's intimidating because of their own experiences. So how can they then effectively support their child when they're seeing probably their child replaying how they were at school? And it's hard because they don't feel that they have the confidence or the tools to support their child, but also to have conversations with the school openly and get support. So I think it's just vital that we break down those barriers in whatever way it takes to do so.
Really good point, Catherine. Totally agree.
But so if there was something, Roger, that schools can do, because schools will say, oh, it's really difficult, we're under so many pressures, we've got so many different agendas being pushed on us. Is there something that schools could do really quickly, say after half term, to make a difference that is going to be cost sort of neutral, cost nothing really, because they will, that's another pressure, schools don't have money to spend. Is there something they could do that would have an impact for this group of people?
Well, I wish I had the magic wand, but I don't. And this thing about cost, I massively push back against that. And I'm talking to government ministers about that, not only in education, but in the prison service. If we are going to make a difference to the way that neuroatypical individuals behave in our community, we can't be looking to do it on the cheap, because that's not going to work. So if there's a cost challenge, we've got to find a solution to that. If the government won't give us the funding to it, we've got to engage with other organisations that might come up with some money for us, Prince's Trust, local businesses, large businesses. Currys are doing this thing at the moment with trying to challenge the digital divide. We've got to think creatively. We've got to think outside the box. We can't be thinking, oh, let's do some free volunteer work with people who are dyslexic at the weekend. We've got to be thinking systematically to challenge the status quo, which is not working. That's why we've got 50% of the prison population being dyslexic. We can't allow this to continue, because it's just a systematic failure, which to me is tantamount to abuse. And in any other form, we would call it out. But as you mentioned, with the parents of neuroatypical individuals, generally their voices are not the most self-confident voices, for a whole system of reasons, a myriad of reasons. However, you've asked for some fixes. I would definitely try and get all staff And by all staff, that means your secretaries, the head teachers, your cleaners, bring the whole team together so that they can better understand what it's like to be Asperger's in the playground when nobody wants to play football with you because you haven't got great communication skills. What it's like to be dyspraxic and nobody wants to play football with you because you kick the ball in the wrong direction. You know, what are the practical implications and how does it make the individual, that young person, feel? And how can we start to bridge some of that negativity into positivity?
Mm.
I think that there's loads of IT that can be brought in, but with IT, we've got to be really careful that we don't see that as being the magic wand, because we've got this huge problem with the digital disconnect. And there's a brilliant book by who I would recommend everybody read. This one, if you can see it, Helper's The Digital Disconnect. She's at LSE and she's got some fantastic ideas about why we have the digital disconnect, how it impacts particularly the cohort that we're talking about today, Catherine. Poverty and dyslexia and Asperger's and ADHD run hand in hand. You know, it's not surprising when we find that people who are neuroatypical, living in families, who are living in the cheapest rental areas in our communities, with all the problems that poverty brings to the table, heightened crime, heightened unemployment, heightened drug use, all these kind of privacy issues that are going on in those young people's lives. So they've got huge challenges anyway. But we can use IT in a positive way if it's done with joined up writing. And by that, I mean, it's not done as a quick fix, or we buy a new laptop in the classroom and that's going to fix everything. We have to make sure that the digital interventions are long-term and they're planned long-term. And this is, again, Catherine, coming to the point that we just discussed briefly about it costs money. Yeah. But if you were running, I don't know, John Lewis, Sainsbury's, if you were running a big organization, you'd be putting in place IT support systems for your company, not just for now, but for the next 100 years.
Mm.
Well, we need that long-term vision in education. So the IT spend now is not, oh, it's £10,000 to bring that software into the school. So what? That's got to be £10,000, not over and above your budget. That's got to be part of your budget. And so we need more access to things like tablets, you know, the little IT tablets, so that we can then lend them out to kids to go home, because lots of the cohort that we're talking about don't have access to the internet when they go home. They don't have access to laptops and desktops and smartphones. They just don't. We need to think about buying data for those individuals so that, and obviously controlling the internet access so that they're not going to be open to abuse, but so that if they want to do some homework, they can access some of the books that they're going to need, or a spell checker that they might need, or some of the support software that is available that's fantastic. I know, because different software providers send me this stuff on a regular basis and I attend lots of conferences. But we need to make it accessible, but not just for 6 months. It's got to be for their academic life and then when they go into employment, so that they've got that support system around them to allow individuals to go and succeed and thrive. Not only will the individual benefit from it, but us as a community will benefit from it.
Yeah, absolutely.
I also think,
carry on.
Yeah. I also think that we need to think outside the box, the way that we plan around becoming more inclusive, so that we can draw on local experiences, school locales and college local areas, as to individuals who might be prepared to come forward and share their story of their neuro difference. And they might be a painter and decorator. Brilliant role model for an individual to see in assembly. Well, there's somebody who struggled with their spelling, but now he's got his own business doing paint and decorating or a carpet fair or whoever it might be, so that people can see that there are pathways, there are options. Mm-hmm. And it's not just, because when you're living in an area of poverty and you're seeing role models in your community who are not doing positive things in their community, but they're driving around in a flash car and they've got cash in the pocket. Often they're role models that the neuroatypical individual will want to escalate to because it looks cool.
Yeah.
Even though long-term that will not do really, that will not serve them well to go down that path. I remember doing loads of work with ex-offenders. And they generally comes to a time, age, critical point where they've developed relationships, they might have a partner, they might have started family, and they don't really want to carry on with that pathway that they've chosen.
Mm.
They're maybe sick of the violence, sick of the threats, etc. But it's really difficult to switch your choice. If we can try and encourage younger people to see that they do have more than one option, rather than just selling weed on the corner, if they've got other things that we can try and encourage them to think that they have the ability to do. Otherwise, that systematic abuse that I keep going on about is only going to lead one way for lots of individuals, whether it's drug abuse, alcohol abuse, whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think
right, I'll shut up for a minute.
On the back of that, I quite often talk to teachers around and those training to teach around thinking about assessment and how we can get children to show us. And this isn't just children with dyslexia, dyspraxia, or anything like this. It's every child. We assess in a certain way. Now, I appreciate fully that we do need to help students prepare for the endpoint assessment that we have no choice over, which is now predominantly exam. However, I encourage student teachers to think about how they're assessing. And when we give them an outcome, and this is how you're going to present it, is limiting. But it's easier for the teacher to mark 30 of the same. If you said to a child, I want you to show me what you know about, and it's your choice how you show me, then we start to understand what children know and what they've learned. To me, quite often, this happens in universities a lot, where essays are still fairly dominant. Are you assessing, in all honesty, and we don't need to answer the question, but I tend to throw this out here just for their thought, are we assessing their understanding of the topic, or are we assessing their ability to write a good essay? They're two very different things. And so I would encourage people to think about broadening the ways in which your students can show you.
Excellent.
Rather Catherine. Than narrowing it.
Excellent, Catherine. Find out what they know and work around that. Brilliant.
Yeah, and how they can show you how they like. And use technology, you know, develop other skills as well, because who in their job writes an essay?
Yeah.
Or does an exam? Okay, there are some accountancy, they sit exams, you know, there are things. But actually, it's rare to say you now need to go and write an essay or doing an exam. Writing a blog, much more common, I would say. But anyway, so you've done a lot of work, I know, and led projects. Specifically, I was listening to one about in Manchester the other day about the importance of bringing people together from different sectors, so beyond education, to help move this forward. And the Dyslexia Institute does a lot to support in that way. Talk to me a bit about the work of the Dyslexia Institute, but also the projects about, I suppose it's multi-agency, isn't it, that we hear the term quite commonly?
Yeah, and I think our communities, our society in the UK has been, we've been going through quite a roller coaster of fractures over the last couple of decades or even longer. And I think the forces, the positive forces to bring our communities together to make them stronger have been significantly challenged, whether that's through cuts in services, just across the piece, we've seen a lot of fracturing, and the outspin of that has been, you know, we see the homeless community, we've seen the spike in the use of things like spice, drug, you know, and these issues, they're there for everybody to see. And I think the only way for us to effectively get on top of that in a positive way is to bring lots of different agencies together. And agencies, I call them stakeholders who would not normally consider themselves to have anything to do with a primary school, or to have anything to do with a university, or to have anything to do with an education department in a prison, or to have anything to do with facilitating and supporting somebody in probation service, or who's coming out of the care system. I think at the moment, we've got a very disparate, fractured set of services that are really struggling to provide better outcomes for individuals. And I think if we don't get better at doing it, we're going to see the fallout from that as being more negative in the future, moving forward over the next 5-10 years. Economically, it's going to be really tough, I think, moving forward for the country. I think we've got lots of challenges. We've just come out of COVID. We've got the EU. We've got inflation at 10%. Mm. We've got housing crisis where people haven't got enough houses. We've got lots and lots of significant negative challenges to our society. And to try and address those, we can't just expect our government to come up with a magic wand. We need to start to collaborate more effectively, and we need facilitators to bring those individuals, those stakeholders together. And not just so that it's a bit of whitewashing for a company, or we do volunteer work at the weekend and we repainted the school fence. Things that have got to be a lot more thought through and a lot more integrated in the way that we collaborate. And it's not just, as Ellen was saying with digital inclusion, it's not just a quick fix. These have to be projects that are well thought through and strategic and operate over the next 10, 20 years and become part embedded into the fabric of the way that a company operates. So I see that as being part of the future. So some of the things that we've done, so we're kind of a lobby organisation. We went to the European Parliament in Brussels in 2019, presented the European Dyslexia Charter just before we decided to leave the EU. And that was getting a lot of traction from the president of the Parliament to lots of MEPs across Europe, because these issues that we are facing with neurodifference are being encountered across Europe, across the world. You know, I talk to people in America, in Sweden, in Spain. It's the same issues. So we've got to get better, not only in the UK, but globally. What else? Organised the International Dyslexia Conference. Last year's was Rebel Voices. That went really well. We've just got to get better at doing what we do. And by that, I mean, from the trainee teacher to the pupil in the classroom to the parent, we've got to become better at understanding what it is that the issues around neurodiversity, what that means, and we've got to start coming to terms with it in a way that we don't allow that prejudice and stigma. Pretty much in the way I've often used the analogy of the gay community. In my lifetime, I remember somebody being homosexual in the 70s, or gay, lesbian, sexually different in their orientation. They would be really badly stigmatized and bullied and, you know, picked on. Whereas now, because of their bravery, they've been on a really positive trajectory, and no one would ever think of calling somebody out for having a different sexual orientation to anybody else. It's just nobody's business but theirs. And I think we need to go through that kind of evolution. moving forward.
We do. There is a really fantastic podcast actually on Bowden where I interviewed an academic, a neurodiverse academic, and talking about his journey and being a neurodiverse academic, reflecting back on his school time, who's currently on a PhD journey. And that's interesting to hear of the differing journey and the challenges to get where he is. So to finish off, Roger, it's back to you really personally. Do you have or hold up to be one of your greatest achievements to date? What would you say?
Well, I think taking the 19 people from Greater Manchester to Brussels to go and present in the European Parliament was excellent, because the vast majority of those individuals are neurodiverse or physically handicapped themselves. We had 3 wheelchair users. It was quite something to see. It was great. I think what I'm most proud of at the moment is my kind of limited involvement with what's going on at government at the moment, to try and give a voice to not only the dyslexic community, but other members of the neurodiverse community in things like the education white paper, the SEND green paper, etc. I think moving forward, that's what I'm proudest of at the moment, is I'm kind of trying to get to talk to people who are at the moment planning governmental change, but historically, I don't think governments of all colours have not really understood the size of the issue, the complexity of the issue. And as a consequence, some of the changes that have been implemented have not perhaps served our cohort as well as they might have done in the past.
And then to finish, is there one ambition that you still hold and hope to achieve in your work?
That's a really good question. Sounds like a desert island.
It does, doesn't it? It's hard. I ask everyone. Lots.
That's a massive one. I would love it to be free for people to have an assessment of whatever their neurodiverse condition is and when they want it. So when they're 7 or they're 70, for them to go and get it, just like that, without having to pay the £500, the £1,000, the £2,000, whatever it is that's a massive obstacle for loads of people, that they could just say to the GP, actually, I've been really struggling with this. Can you get me assessed? And not only then to get assessed, but then to have a pathway of support
from that,
and self-development. That, I think, in a nutshell, Catherine, would be my dream.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would absolutely support that. And that would completely work on the equity that we're looking at, social justice models, and dare I say, levelling up and things like that, that are their current buzzwords. But we can't ignore the fact that it isn't just about children's needs. Their needs are compounded or otherwise by their ability to pay for assessments, for example, and have the equipment that they need. So thank you so much, Roger, for this fascinating chat. You can go and visit the Dyslexia Institute website at dyslexiainstituteuk.com, and of course follow Roger at Aguilas33 Roger on Twitter, and that's Aguilas, A-G-U-I-L-A-S 33 Roger.
Also on the Dyslexia Institute UK Twitter. Okay,
perhaps better. And is it Dyslexia Institute UK?
It's Dyslexia Institute One.
There you go. Follow those on Twitter. Thanks, thank you so much for your time today, Roger.
Thanks, Catherine. It'd be lovely talking to you.